In 2072, a rogue artificial intelligence known as Shodan lost her mind. In her limitless imagination, Shodan saw herself as a goddess, destined to inherit the Earth. That image was snuffed out by the hacker who created her.
Welcome to a special preview of Pantheon of the Blood God, our monthly podcast devoted to exploring the very best RPGs of all time. I'm Kat Bailey, and this month's selection is System Shock 2, which was frequently lauded as one of the greatest horror RPGs of all time. System Shock 2 can trace its lineage back to classic dungeon crawlers like Wizardry, which subsequently branched into so-called immersive sims like Ultima Underworld. System Shock 2 was special because it successfully combined the shooter genre and the RPG genre for the first time, paving the way for later hits like Deus Ex. It also was really special in the way that it utilized audio and environmental design to create an atmosphere of real dread. Our special guest this month is Jeff Green, who was at CGW when System Shock 2 came out, and he has plenty of great stories to tell from that time period. If you want to hear the full episode, check out patreon.com/bloodgodpod and sign up at the $10 level, which will give you access to our other podcast explorations of Final Fantasy VIII, Lufia 2, and Skies of Arcadia, as well as our Legend of Zelda 35th Anniversary Tribute and our complete watch of The Witcher on Netflix. Okay, let's continue on to our special preview of Pantheon of the Blood God, System Shock 2. Don't go away. I think any conversation about System Shock 2 really has to start with Ultima Underworld. Warren Spector. Ultima Underworld was a big deal when it came out in March 1992. It combined elements of wizardry with realistic interactions to create what some like to call the immersive sim. Warren Spector would go on to make the original System Shock, which was primitive. It didn't even have mouse look. Nevertheless, it had a cult following. I think that the first thing that the CGW review points out is that it wasn't actually a failure. It sold like 170,000 units, but at the time, it was known as kind of a game that nobody really played, but people were kind of aware of. Did you play the original System Shock, Jeff?
I did back in the day. I like probably not since then, so I can't even recall if it would hold up. I do remember that there were a lot of Doom comparisons at the time, which was such an odd thing in retrospect. But you know, everything was. If it was remotely like Doom, it was a Doom clone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mouse hook thing, too, was like, I mean, that was all those games, right? I mean, mouse hook just wasn't a thing back then. Doom didn't have it. It was really...
That's right. Doom was very straight ahead. And
yeah.
Everything, there was no, like, aiming up or down. It was just what it was.
That's right. If there was something, you know, 6 feet above you, you just aimed straight and it would hit.
It was funny that we thought of those games as being in 3D, even though you were fighting 2D sprites and you couldn't look up or down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting that.
There was no sense of verticality either, because you could go upstairs, but you couldn't jump. That wasn't a thing in the original Doom.
Right. Now, Marathon, which was on the Mac at first, that had mouse hook. That was one of Bungie's first games. Doesn't really get the credit for the innovation that it had.
Oh, interesting.
I remember the original Dark Forces had mouse look as well, and that made a huge difference. But I picked up Dark Forces in like 1995, 96, whenever it came out, and I was still definitely playing with the arrow keys at that time. That was how you played first-person shooters. So
absolutely. Yep. I remember, I've mentioned Elliot Chin 3 times now in this podcast. He was the guy at CGW who taught the rest of us how to do circle strafing in shooters.
Ah.
Because that was such a big deal.
So he was destroying you all in Doom Deathmatch?
Completely.
Well, some years later, Looking Glass Studios approaches Irrational Games and asks if they'd like to make a System Shock-like game baby together, as Nadia writes. Looking Glass was a fan of System Shock and wanted to make something similar. Looking Glass Studios, of course, was the studio behind Thief: The Dark Project, which was a pretty big deal in the late 90s. People hadn't really experienced stealth action games at that time. We all kind of like to credit Metal Gear for sort of inventing the genre, but I think in many ways, Thief the Dark Project codified it, as it were.
Right. Well, and, you know, that was a PC console dichotomy too, right?
Yeah.
Metal Gear wasn't on PCs. For me, the big difference, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm less familiar with Metal Gear as a series overall. But Thief, the big thing was the use of light and shadows as part of the stealth game. That a whole lot of it had to do with, you know, shooting out lights or I guess it was what candles or whatever it was at the time in the game as a way of masquerading your appearance from the
AI. I don't think the PlayStation could handle that. God bless it. It was very much a matter of keeping out of the enemy's sight and maybe fooling them by knocking on, making a sound and making it seem like it was coming from somewhere else. And that was considered like really, well, at the time it was really incredible AI. So, but I don't recall there being like a big deal using dark and shadow and light.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't doing those things, but you could do things like the enemies would notice your footprints in the snow. For example,
right.
So you could lure them that way.
It was more about enemy AI and how clever it was. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the one problem I remember having with Thief at the time was, you know, you could use your arrows to shoot out all the lights around the enemy AI. And like, yes, now you were invisible to them, but like they wouldn't react. So, you know, you have these guards on patrol and like, and now everything's dark and they're just like, doo-doo-doo. Yeah, just kind of broke the immersion for me. Yeah.
That's great. I love that shit. We were just talking about that with Skyrim and stuff like that. Oh, the guy got an arrow. The guy next to me got an arrow in the eye. Yeah. What was that? Oh, it was nothing, I guess.
Well, Looking Glass was a publisher based in Massachusetts. It was founded by Paul Neurath and Ned Lerner as Blue Sky Studios in 1990. It ended up closing in 2000 for a multitude of reasons, including bad sales of newer games, deals with Eidos and Sony that fell through, and the cancellation of a spy game called Deep Cover. I remember Looking Glass was kind of a darling at that time. People really talked very fondly about that studio, but it never seemed like any of their games could sell was the problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It seemed to hit a lot of bad luck, just a lot of... They've gone over it themselves, people who've worked there, and said there's no one thing that killed the studio, just a lot of just a stream of bad luck.
Well, the game was initially called Junction Point, and the story had Heart of Darkness vibes, wherein you were supposed to assassinate a starship Captain Gone Mad. Sounds kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, it does.
Mm-hmm.
Junction Point's RPG elements, seen in the dungeon-crawling style of gameplay, the stat building, the inventory management, was made particularly prominent to prevent the game from being dismissed as a Doom clone, which, of course, it ultimately was.
Well, Half-Life.
Or a Half-Life yes. clone. Which the team believed kept the first System Shock from achieving financial success. An early design doc states, the character grows, not just their gun collection. Junction Point was pitched to multiple publishers, including EA, who owned the System Shock property through its purchase of Origin. It just said, say, why don't we make this a System Shock sequel? Whereupon game designer Ken Levine said, sure. And that was how System Shock 2 was born. The story was changed accordingly, but the gameplay remained the same. It had a very small team, a very young team, and it had a budget of about $700,000. So not a lot of resources. And this was around the time that games were costing, you know, had larger development teams and were costing millions of dollars to develop. So $700,000 was not a lot.
Yeah, I have to say, coming as someone who is actually still very new to the game, I actually played it for the first time. A lot of the graphics do hold up beyond the fact some of the character models look like they're made out of 6 polygons. Like the environments themselves still look quite good and still have that real sense of atmosphere to them. So good on them for doing that with quite a small budget and a very young team.
Irrational Games was formed in 1997 from three former Looking Glass employees, Ken Levine, Jonathan Che, and Robert Fermier. They were responsible for System Shock 2, of course, Freedom Force, SWAT 4, and the game that maybe is their most famous production, which was Bioshock. Irrational was acquired by Take-Two in 2007, and in 2014, it was restructured as Ghost Story Games, with it focusing on immersive story-driven games. We haven't heard or seen what Levine has up his sleeve since then. Ken Levine a lot of controversy around that particular move because he basically said, well, I'm tired of running irrational. I'm going to size down the staff a lot. And a lot of people lost their jobs as a result.
Yeah, Levine's a figure, all right.
He is a figure, and we should probably talk about him right now. So Ken Levine started out as a writer and director in television and movies, which explains why his games are so steeped in narration. Some of his works, MASH, Frasier, Cheers, Everybody Hates Raymond. Everybody Hates Raymond.
I slipped that in there, sorry.
Thank you, Nadia.
I wanted to see if you would notice.
And The Simpsons. He co-wrote Dancin' Homer and also the go-kart episode in season 3. So, but it doesn't sound like his time in Hollywood really worked out because eventually he came over to video games and that's where he's been ever since. Apparently got into games in 1995 after answering an ad for Looking Glass in Next Gen magazine. And he ended up working on Thief. He founded Irrational Games in 97 and worked on System Shock 2 and then eventually BioShock. Jeff, have you ever actually met Ken Levine? I imagine you have.
I have, quite a few times. We bonded over our Jewishness, among other things.
Yeah, we can bond over Jewishness as well.
Hi. Awesome. Hey, happy Passover.
MOT. Yeah.
He's a very funny guy, very talented guy. Had an almost return to Hollywood. I'm not sure how much this has been talked about. Post BioShock. I just remember running into him at an event, and he was hired to make a remake of Logan's Run. And I don't know if it ever. I guess it clearly it never got off the ground because it hasn't happened. But he's an opinionated guy and a very big personality. And I know that if you talk to former employees at Irrational, there's a lot of people who had a great time and a lot of people who did not have a great time. My personal experience with him is he was always just a stand-up guy with me and a fun guy to talk to. But a controversial figure, no doubt.
One of those auteurs who really exercises a lot of hands-on control over the development of his games, especially with BioShock Infinite.
Right. That's probably the main thing I heard was, and this is all hearsay, of course, so, you know, but people I talked to worked at Irrational. It's like, if you were on, you know, in his good graces, you were fine. But once you were not, you were totally not. So
one thing that I can say about Ken Levine, and I mean, I'm sure that the development team added a lot of to this as well, because it's always a mistake to attribute anything to any one person. But Ken Levine's games tend to be really good at environmental storytelling, and that's the case in both System Shock 2 and in BioShock. And I'm not going to say that he invented it, but he really helped push it forward in a lot of ways, especially with concepts like audio logs, which arguably was invented in System Shock 2.
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, the last time that I played System Shock 2, I marveled at the fact that, you know, in my mind, it was like a big story with like, big plot arc, which it does have, you know, multiple characters that you get to know. You get to know their personalities. But when you play the game, it's just you. You know, you are alone. Mm-hmm. And that aloneness, of course, was part of the experience. And yet they did so much so effectively with audio logs, which, of course, can just be kind of a drag and kind of a way to sort of shove your story off to the side without doing anything. But somehow the folks at Irrational were able to make it work.
I think one of the reasons it works, in my opinion, is because you're still always, alongside the audio logs, you're still following that voice that's always kind of goading you along and stringing you and telling you where to go.
True.
They're kind of like extensions of that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, using sound design, and he is not a big fan, seemingly, of cutscenes that take away from the character, like a lot of games at this time would go into in-engine cutscenes where it would move into a little bit letterbox format and the camera is panning across the character. More often than not in System Shock 2, it remains in first-person point of view as the story is happening, or you'll be running down a hallway while Shodan is talking to you. One of the few examples I can think of where that is not happening, for example, is at the end, interestingly enough, where it becomes more traditional in that kind of way. And I think that's one of the kind of the weaker elements, even if it is also kind of hilarious. System Shock 2 was directed and programmed by Jonathan Chay. Some of his notable credits include Bioshock, Thief 2, Tribes Vengeance, and Void Bastards. Chay worked on Thief the Dark Project, and that game's Dark Engine was utilized for System Shock 2. It led to a lot of problems. Dark Engine was unfinished, which forced the dev team to fix a lot of bugs. The Dark Engine's unfinished state left it very malleable, however, which Chay still regards as a cursed blessing. At times, we long for a finished and frozen engine with an unalterable API that was rigidly defined and implemented, the perfect black box. But being able to tamper with the engine allowed us to change it to support System Shock-specific features in ways that a game general engine never could. And I think that because it uses the Dark Engine from Thief, you can see a lot of the influence from Thief in System Shock 2, specifically the stealth elements.
Yeah, there's a lot of shooting out cameras, even early in the game. If you don't shoot out those cameras, you'll get swarmed very quickly, as I learned the hard way.
Yeah, and things like enemies can hear your footsteps and will react to them. It's easy to get swarmed in this game, so you definitely want to be pretty careful about how you approach individual encounters. It's definitely, there's a run-and-gun element to System Shock 2, but not in the same way as a game like Doom, for example.
Really, especially for modern audiences, if you go back to System Shock 2, it's actually pretty difficult. I mean, comparatively to what we're used to now, I think both for shooters and for RPGs, you know, they really stack the odds against you. There's the security cameras and the turrets are absolutely brutal. And of course, you can learn hacking skills, which can take out the cameras and the turrets, but the points you get for upgrades along those lines are very stingily doled out.
They are.
You know, you have to really make some big choices. I imagine we'll get into that as what you want to develop into your character. But even if you focus on tech, it's still difficult to hack those things, because first you have to have enough points to do it, and then you have to actually succeed in the little mini games to do the hacking.
Yeah, they had those mini games in Bioshock 2, and it was a modification. I think the game is Pipes, and I love Pipes, so I was really good at those. But System Shock 2, you're right, it actually shocked me a little bit, so to speak, at how much more unforgiving it was next to Bioshock, even on easy.
Yes.
Like it's you will be just brutalized. I think for one thing, there is no auto recover at all in that game, whereas in Bioshock, you stand off to the side for a bit, you can recover. In System Shock 2, the best you can hope for is you have a health hypo, and even when you like plug that into yourself, it's not like, oh, here's 50 hit points, yeah, you're good. You have to plug that in, and you have to kind of stand off somewhere and let yourself recharge for a little bit, and that's all it will do for you. And so there's not a lot of second chances in this game. The save system is not forgiving.
It's not forgiving. The health hypos themselves, unless you know, a couple points, you have the option of increasing their effectiveness. But for the most part, they don't fully heal you. You know, you start out with something like, 30 or 40 hit points to start with.
Yeah, so it's not a lot.
You're very weak from the very start. And with things like the hacking, it actually costs every time you hack. So the in-game currency is nanites, and you have to pay just to do the hack.
Just to fail.
Yeah, and if you fail, you have to pay again. So you could actually just run out of the currency to just heal to do the hacking, let alone do anything else in the game.
One of the things that Chay talks about is how young the development team was. And I think this is a pretty common trope in the late 90s. You had a lot of young game developers coming up who were kind of precocious, and they had big ideas about how they wanted to approach game design, because game technology was changing so rapidly, and we were finally able to start creating the worlds that we had always kind of wanted to create in the interactive space. I think Ken Levine was definitely in that mold. And Shay said, to a certain extent, inexperience also bred enthusiasm and commitment that might not have been present with a more jaded set of developers, i.e. they worked themselves to death to try and create the perfect game.
I.e. crunch, crunch, crunch. We're framing it as a real go-getter sort of thing, but yeah, crunch.
The artist was Gareth Hines. He's a mixed media artist based in DC. He's responsible for much of System Shock 2's concept art. He currently does graphic novel adaptations of classic literature, which is actually kind of cool. Apparently there's a Macbeth one.
Yeah, there's a Macbeth one that I really want to, want to buy. Yeah, it looks really awesome.
System Shock 2 has very good art, though it's also very late 90s art. I think of Image Comics when I think of System Shock 2 in a lot of ways.
Oh, it absolutely is. It's actually really interesting to see his art now because it's so different, so much softer.
And then there was the composers. System Shock 2 has a really interesting, heavy, reverb, synth-driven soundtrack. In some ways, it feels like the forerunner to Mass Effect. It was composed by three different people. So there was Josh Randall, one of Looking Glass Studios' former directors and musicians. He's an eternal legend for using footage of his colonoscopy as a texture for the body of the many.
He sure did.
What a sacrifice. I mean,
have either of you had a colonoscopy?
No.
Yes, I have.
I have.
Sorry to say.
I have. Well, you're an older fellow.
Yes,
not to say like as an assaulting way, but yeah, you would have. I've had one just because I had problems. And they don't let you keep the footage, at least not here. I think it belongs to the government. So I can't put it in a video game.
I'll be honest, the time, I guess I've had it twice in my dotage. And I can honestly say I never thought to ask if I could have the footage.
Same, to be honest with you.
Well, that explains why the body of the many looks like kind of so off-putting and gross and organic. Like, okay, yeah, we were looking at a dude's colonoscopy in a video game.
That tracks. Look at episode of King of the Hill.
They're going to eventually remake System Shock 2. I hope they don't get too realistic with it.
Oh, HD colonoscopies. Oh, man. Oh, now we're talking.
You wanted something a little different, albeit creepy, for System Shock 2's sound. When we started working on Shock 2, we knew we wanted a driving electronic sound. The soundtrack to Shock 1 by Greg Lopiccolo was pretty iconic, but we wanted to go darker. And I think that they really succeed, especially when you get to some of the bigger moments, like when Shodan first reveals herself. The thing that's interesting about System Shock 2, and I think is actually kind of ahead of its time, is how sparingly it uses music. And when it uses its music, it's to really punctuate a moment. And I think it's extremely effective in that regard.
Yes. One thing that I remember is that when you do fail at the security, or when you set off the security, that's also when a lot of the electronics music will kick in. So, I mean, it's a musical cue that lets you know you're in trouble. And you, I think it's like a minute or two that every monster in the whole game is looking for you. But it really ups the tension of that situation.
There was also Ramin Djawadi, a German composer who scored TV shows, movies, and games, including System Shock 2. He scored Game of Thrones. Josh noted that he was really good at creepy atmospheric stuff, clearly. And then finally, there was Eric Brosius. System Shock 2 was eventually released in August of 1999. It was reviewed in CGW by Deathlock, which, hey, it's a Star Blazers reference. I appreciate that.
Is that a Star Blazers reference?
That was the main.
Because I actually. Because I actually just watched a kind of a, not really a long retrospective on Star Blazer, but it looks kind of cool. I want to watch Yamato now.
It's a Yamato 2199. Strongly recommend. It's very good.
It definitely seems cool.
If you like System Shock 2, you'll probably like Yamato 2199. No, just kidding. I don't know. I just wanted to connect them somehow. Classic anime, though. But yes, Deathlock said, even though the game features a novel setting and contains significant RPG elements, gameplay doesn't evolve significantly beyond that of recent first-person shooters. You'll spend much of your time firing at enemies around corners, opening crates, and engaging in key hunts that demand meticulous exploration. IGN said, the one warning that I would offer up to hardcore action fans who may be put off by the RPG elements that make this game what it is. In the end, though, I would recommend this title for just about anyone who's over the age of 16. This game is really scary and who likes deep, rich play adventures. It ultimately beat sales of the original, but Looking Glass lost money on the project, which is kind of a common theme with Looking Glass, unfortunately.
It seems to be, yeah. I guess that's kind of an example of the bad luck. Here I was even thinking, when I was researching this, I was thinking, okay, well, maybe at least had a hit with System Shock 2, but no, they didn't even have that.
Since then, I think, as we were already mentioning, System Shock 2 seemed to kind of enjoy a second renaissance around the time of the release of BioShock, because everybody was saying, hey, this game BioShock that you love, have you ever tried System Shock 2 Showdown? Am I right? It was, I think its legacy was hurt ever so slightly by the fact that it was never released on console, because it was never meant to be. The control scheme was way too complicated, but that meant that an entire subsection of the gaming community never really got to enjoy it in the same way that BioShock fans did. Nevertheless, it consistently appears on greatest games of all time lists. A lot of people talk about how it's an amazing pioneer of horror gameplay. Vice lauded it the timeless horror of System Shock 2. And along with BioShock, it's the game most consistently cited as Ken Levine's kind of magnum opus. It was hugely influential on the games that followed, from Deus Ex to BioShock to Prey 2017. And at this very moment, Night Dive Studios is remaking the original System Shock with updated combat, and System Shock 2 Enhanced Edition is on the way with VR support.
Exciting. Mm. Oh my God, that'd be terrifying.
Oh God, so I can barf and scream.
Seriously.
Barf while screaming. System Shock 2. This game will make you barf in terror. Nadia Oxford. That's the Blood Guy.
There's a back of the box quote for you.
Thanks so much for listening to our special preview of our Pantheon of the Blood God exploration of System Shock 2. Again, if you want to hear the full episode, you can access it at the $10 level at patreon.com/bloodgodpod. As always, we appreciate your support. And next month, we'll be back to talk about Terranigma, the classic top-down action RPG that never made it to North America. Until then, for Nadia, Jeff, and myself, thanks for listening, and happy adventuring.